I'm thankful for the love of God this morning. Amen. Aren't you? Without it, he would have been done with me a long, long time ago. And you too, so don't look at me like that, all right? Let's turn to Luke chapter 15. And we're going to talk about that. We're talk about the love of God this morning. Luke chapter 15. This is a big one this morning, all right? You can't split Luke 15 up. It's hard to do. It's in response to some complaints against Jesus, and it's meant to be read as one unit. And so we're gonna do our best here today to cover it. And frustrating to me because I'm thinking all the good meaty stuff we're like leaving out, but we'd be here for 8 hours, which would be fun, but no one laughed. Luke chapter 15. I'm gonna read the whole thing. So. Just follow along. You're right, Tim. Luke 15. Tim's my biggest. I love having Tim out here, man. He encourages us. Now the tax collectors and sinners were all drawing near to hear him. And the Pharisees and the scribes grumbled, saying, "This man receives sinners and eats with them." So he told them this parable. What man of you, having 100 sheep, if he has lost one of them, does not leave the 99 in the open country and go after the one that is lost until he finds it? And when he has found it, he lays it on his shoulders rejoicing. And when he comes home, he calls together his friends and his neighbors, saying to them, "Rejoice with me, for I have found my sheep that was lost." Just so, I tell you, there will be more joy in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 righteous persons who need no repentance. Or what woman, having 10 silver coins, if she loses one coin, does not light a lamp and sweep the house and seek diligently until she finds it? And when she's found it, she calls together her friends and neighbors, saying, "Rejoice with me, for I have found the coin that I lost." Just so, I tell you, there is joy before the angels of God over one sinner who repents. And he said, there was a man who had 2 sons. And the younger of them said to his father, "Father, give me the share of property that is coming to me." And he divided his property between them. Not many days later, the younger son gathered all he had and took a journey into a far country. And there he squandered his property in reckless living. And when he had spent everything, a severe famine arose in that country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to one of the citizens of that country, who sent him into his fields to feed pigs. And he was longing to be fed with the pods that the pigs ate, and no one gave him anything. But when he came to himself, he said, "How many of my father's hired servants have more than enough bread, but I perish here with hunger? I will arise and go to my father, and I will say to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me as one of your hired servants.' And he arose and came to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and felt compassion, and ran and embraced him and kissed him. And the son said to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to his servants, 'Bring quickly the best robe and put it on him, and put a ring on his hand and shoes on his feet, and bring the fattened calf and kill it, and let us eat and celebrate. For this my son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.' And they began to celebrate. Now his older son was in the field, and as he came and drew near to the house, he heard music and dancing. And he called one of the servants and asked what these things meant. And he said to him, 'Your brother has come, and your father has killed the fattened calf because he has received him back safe and sound.' But he was angry and refused to go in. His father came out and entreated him. But he answered his father, 'Look, these many years I've served you, and I never disobeyed your command. Yet you never gave me a young goat that I might celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours came, who has devoured your property with prostitutes, you killed the fattened calf for him. And he said to him, son, you are always with me. All that is mine is yours. It was fitting to celebrate and be glad. For this, your brother was dead and is alive. He was lost and is found. God, this is just an amazing chapter. And it shows us your heart. It helps us see who we are, and it helps us see your love for us. So God, I pray that you just take it and use it today. Use the power of your word, the power of these words that Jesus spoke so many years ago. And help me to communicate them clearly today, Lord. We pray that your spirit would take your powerful word and change us and encourage us and build us up in our faith today. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. There's a song, it's been popular for a little while now. I think Sam Schellenberg sang it a while back. Oh, the overwhelming, never-ending, reckless love of God. Oh, it chases me down, fights till I'm found, leaves the 99. I couldn't earn it, and I don't deserve it. Still, you give yourself away. Oh, the overwhelming, never-ending, reckless love of God. Based on Luke 15. The idea of the reckless love of God, Tim Keller also played on that in a book he wrote called Prodigal God, where he's referencing the same thing, that the love of God, just incredible and unimaginable, and we see that portrayed here in the different figures in this story, these three stories, actually. So here's some background. Jesus tells these stories in response to a familiar criticism. Right, a familiar criticism. We've heard it two other times in the book of Luke so far, directed at him from the religious leaders and the Pharisees. That this man eats with sinners. This man welcomes tax collectors and prostitutes. In Luke 5 and Luke 7, Jesus was accused of that two different times. In Luke 5, he gives that very well-known response where he says, look, the Son of Man came to seek and save that which was lost. It's not the healthy who needs a doctor, it's the sick. It's not the righteous who need rescued, it's the lost. And in Luke chapter 7, Jesus again is accused and looked down upon by the Pharisees, by Simon the Pharisee, because he let the woman there wash his feet, and Jesus comes back at him with a story and says, Let me ask you a question, Simon. And he tells him a story about two debtors, and one who owed more than the other one. And he says, Who loved more? Well, it's the one who understood that they were lost, the one who understood they were a great sinner. And he's like, that's what I'm here for, Simon. To rescue people who are lost. And then you come here again in Luke 15, and once again, they grumble against Jesus. This one's even nuanced a little bit differently because here it says, this man receives sinners. It almost implies, it's almost nuanced in that it's not just that Jesus was necessarily invited to eat with them, kind of like Zacchaeus. And maybe Jesus is going just to be polite, but it's like, no, this man welcomes. It's almost nuanced that Jesus is the host. Jesus is the one drawing them in, and this irritates the religious leaders. Why would you do that, Jesus? You call yourself a rabbi. You're supposed to be a holy man. You don't hang around with people like that. Why? It's not fitting. It's not proper. So these next three parables are Jesus' response to that criticism. He wants them to see something. He wants them to feel something. He wants them to understand that the reason why I eat with tax collectors and sinners is because that's what God does. It's his heart to reach out to the lost. Ever lose something? That meant a lot to you? Spent time looking for it? I have. I lose lots of things. Probably the most important thing I've ever lost is actually sitting down here in the second row. I lost Hannah one time. I'm going to say I, so I don't implicate mommy in this. The 4th of July celebration down in Ada. Very many of you have been there. 4th of July down in Ada. It's crazy. And carnival rides and crafts and food, and it's a blast, and tons of people down there. And so Hannah was 4 years old, And like every other child at the 4th of July celebration was wearing the red Old Navy t-shirt with the American flag on the front. So when someone asked, you know, when we lost her, what's she wearing? We're like, well, like what everyone's wearing. So that's not going to be helpful. But yeah, so we're standing there. We're waiting to do this ride. And, you know, Maggie was just really, so, you know, mommy and daddy are still adjusting here to, you know, life with three kids. We're now outnumbered, you know, so we're like trying to manage all three kids. And, you know, just like, hey, where's Hannah? I'm like, I don't know. Hannah? Where's Hannah? You know, and there's other church people were there with us. And like, she was right here, you know, and let me look down here for a minute, and, you know, and she's got to be here. And all of a sudden, you know, like 1 minute turns into like 2 minutes, turns into 3 minutes. And all of a sudden, it kind of starts to sink in, like, my daughter's missing. And this is a little scary. And we start, like, 3 minutes turns into 5 minutes. To be honest with you, I don't remember the time frame. I mean, it seems like an hour, you know. But it was a significant amount of time. And we're looking, and Jimmy was there, and remember Kathy Murray and other people from church, like, okay, and people started looking, and we started spreading out and looking around, and we're walking, we go over to this tent, and we're looking over there, and Kathy's somewhere, and I think Stephanie Dow was there, and it was, Stephanie? She's freaking out. You can't imagine that, I know, but, you know, I think she was crying, you know, and we're all looking, and can't find Hannah. And so I remember Jimmy kind of caught up with me, and I'm walking down this one direction, Jimmy's like, hey, he goes, let's call my dad. And Dave, his dad, is in the fire department down there in Ada. Let's call my dad and the sheriff. There's a couple sheriffs around. We'll get him. And I'm like, yeah, probably need to let them know. And like now it's like I'm feeling sick. Like this is the only thing in my world right now. I'm trying to find my daughter. And all of a sudden, I look right as Jimmy's. I think he even had his cell phone. I'm about to call, and I look down. I'm like, wait a minute. And I look all the way down the end of this line of like inflatables. Now at the end, there's a strawberry game or the ride. You sit in and it rotates. And sitting there in line, waiting to get on the ride, is this little girl looked really familiar. I'm like, Jimmy, I think I found her. And we went down, and there's Hannah. And I'm like, Hannah. Now, parents, you know how this is, right? Because at that moment, there are two very intense emotions that you're feeling. It's like you're so overwhelmed. I love this kid. I'm crying. I'm so relieved. And I'm like, I'm going to kill you, right? I mean, they're both going on at the same time, right? You understand this, right, parents? I'm not the – okay. And so, you know, we find her and hug her to love on. I mean, I feel like so relieved. And like, we're walking back. I'm like, what are you doing? She's like, riding rides. I'm like, you know, and I'm like, fine. I'm like, did you ride that one? She's like, yeah, I already rode that. I'm like, what are that one? Yeah, I rode that one too. And she, like, it was all the inflatable. She had gone and done them all. Like, this 4-year-old could care less that she was. She was like, I'm free, you know. And she's, but we were so relieved to have found Hannah. Hannah, thank you for letting me tell that story. And I just got the Hannah look. But, right, this is what Jesus is communicating here. Why do you do that, Jesus? Well, no, it's what I do. Like a parent drops everything and goes and looks for their lost child because it's the only thing that matters to me. He's like, this matters to me. This is what God does. He goes and looks. So let me tell you a couple stories here to illustrate that, right? Let me tell you about sheep. These portraits of lostness, all right? He says, what man of you who has 100 sheep loses one and doesn't go look for it, right? It's a rhetorical question because everyone sitting there at the time would know exactly what a shepherd would do. Everyone hearing Jesus ask that question would go, yeah, you're going to go look for the lost sheep. You're going to go seek to find it. And so that's what happens here. The shepherd leaves the 99 in the field, in the wilderness. Now, you understand, he wasn't acting irresponsibly by doing this. They worked in partnership, in pairs, and he would, at the very least, would have had an assistant. And we see as the parable goes on, he leaves the wilderness, and he brings the sheep back home. So somewhere in there, the sheep had been led back to their home pen and everything. That's where he goes and meets them later. So he's not irresponsible by leaving the 99, but he's taking on a great task, walking back down the trail to go look for the sheep. It was probably towards the end of the day, the fact that they were doing a count here, maybe before their final movement home. But regardless, I mean, this is like, oh, I remember one time on a wilderness trip, we had left, the students, it's always their fault. We had a dry bag with a spot locator, GPS locator, and some important medication. We had gotten left back at Portage along the trail. So we were about four and a half hours into our day. We realized this when we had stopped for lunch. We put it together that bag was left about 2 hours back at a Portage. So Dave Stevens and I are like, okay, you guys keep going. Gwen and Jimmy, you guys are in charge. Take them to camp. And we'll go back and we'll find this back. So Dave and I start back. So again, we're already four and a half hours here. We're like, all right, we'll go back to, we can probably go light. We can make it back there in an hour and a half or so. Yeah, but we're going upstream. So, so we get back to that. We pass someone. We find out that that someone had found the bag, and we were relieved that. But then they said, yeah, they took it back to McIntosh Lake. McIntosh is where we started that day. So we go another like hour and a half, 2 hours back. And then we get it, and then we go the 4 hours back to where we had lunch, and then the other 4 hours back to, needless to say, it was well after dark, we go back. The last thing I wanted to do was go back and retrace all of those steps to find that bag. But we did, because it was important. And that's exactly what the shepherd does. End of the day, maybe looking forward to hot dinner, shower, relaxing, spending time with his family, but he's like, nope. You go, I'm going back. And he sets back down the trail, retracing the steps from the day to find the sheep. And notice what it says. It searches. He searches until he finds it. Until he finds it. He's not leaving. He's either going to find it alive or dead, but he's not going to leave until he finds this lost sheep. Back down the trail. Putting himself, by the way, in a precarious situation, because like I said, they often worked in partnership in at least multiple, partly because of safety, wild animals and things of that nature. So by going out by himself at this time of day, getting late at night into dark, the shepherd is putting himself in danger. But right, again, think big picture, because isn't this a beautiful picture of the good shepherd of Jesus? This is exactly what Jesus did for us, right? He leaves heaven. He leaves the presence of his Father, and he comes to earth and puts himself in peril to rescue what's lost. It's exactly what this shepherd does. And note this, that the sheep does nothing to prompt the shepherd to begin his search except to become lost. The sheep does nothing to prompt the shepherd to come look for him except get lost. And this, again, describes what Jesus did in his coming, right? It wasn't like God was in heaven and waiting to send Jesus and go, all right, I think people have been righteous enough and have called out just enough. We'll send you now, right? No. While we were still enemies of God, he sent Jesus. We didn't do anything to earn that. We got lost, and he, of his own love and initiative, came to find us. Here's where it gets awesome. There are two celebrations here with the shepherd. The first one happens by himself. If you notice this, right? When he finds the sheep, he joyfully puts it on his shoulders and starts home. All right? So he has a personal celebration first. This is where he does his happy dance that he's embarrassed to do in front of everyone else. All right? This is where he's singing. He's jumping up and down. He finds, he's happy. The job, though, of rescuing the sheep isn't over just by finding him, is it? He picks the sheep up. I don't know how much a full-grown sheep, and the text doesn't tell us, but I'm guessing it was probably a big. He picks the sheep up, puts it on his shoulders, and now he's retracing his steps, walking all the way back to where they realized the sheep was lost, and then beyond taking the sheep home with this thing on his shoulders. And what does it say? He did it joyfully. Joyfully. He's joyful in rescuing this sheep. Here it is, right? Sometimes the work of restoration is hard work. It can be a burden. I confess, sometimes I can start getting to a point where I see people, I see students, sometimes more of a burden. We're not careful. We can let ourselves see people that way. It's kind of natural. It happens. It slips in. We get jaded. But the reality of it is, that when we can have a role in restoring someone, we should find great joy in that. And this shepherd puts this sheep, I don't want that thing on my neck. You know how hot that is? It stinks. Maybe it's wounded. But here's the thing, he joyfully puts it on. And right, you notice he doesn't lecture the sheep. Like if it was me, I think I probably would have found the sheep. I don't know if I would, to be honest, I got 99 others. That's one, you know. It's not what he does. And he doesn't lecture it. So maybe at my best, I would have gone and found the sheep, and I would have been like, all right, I did the work, find it. You're walking home yourself, Fluffy, right? I mean, I'm not carrying you. You're gonna pay for this a little bit. No lecture. No berating the sheep. Picks it up, joyfully puts it on his shoulders, and walks it home. And we find joy in being part of rescuing people and carrying the burden of helping them come back to God. Honestly, I don't always want to do this, but it's the way it should be. And you look at Paul, look no further than Paul, how often throughout his epistles, as he talked about his ministry, look how many times he used the word joy in conjunction with people. I have no greater joy than this. John does the same thing in his epistles. No greater joy to see my children walking with God. Paul's like, now my joy is complete. When he says this about the Thessalonians, my joy is complete that I hear that you're walking with God. Paul found joy in coming along, people. It's a great picture of the shepherd. So here you go. The theme of joy starts here. And this theme of celebration and joy, and we're introduced to it here with the shepherd, and it carries through. It's a major theme throughout Luke 15. So, Pharisees, why do I eat with sinners and say, because I'm the shepherd, I'm the good shepherd. Let me tell you about a woman who lost a coin. She has 10. She loses one. It was probably a drachma. Probably would have been equivalent to one day's wage. Most commentators agree, though, that the worth of this coin probably exceeded its monetary worth. As it was probably some kind of emotional attachment. It could have been part of a dowry. It could have been part of a piece of jewelry. Something like that, that made it incredibly valuable to her. She lights a lamp, and she grabs a broom, and she begins diligently searching. The parable of the sheep doesn't really tell us much about the work that the shepherd did other than putting it on his shoulders, which is a big deal. But this one seems to be emphasizing a little bit more about the intensity of her labor, sweeping with a lamp, with a lantern. You know, she's looking in all the cracks. They would have had a stone floor in the houses, many of the houses there. And so you get all these cracks and crevices, and she seems to feel like that's where this coin went. It probably dropped down in there. And she's looking. That could be a lot of work, different depths between those stones and such. So she's sweeping. She's looking intently. And that seems to be the tone here in this part of the parable. That rescuing a lost, it's hard. It takes effort. It takes work. The cross was work, right? One of the things I'm not particular about many things. Okay, there's a few things. My books. weights in the weight room when people put the like 45s with the 10s go. Like, why? What kind of person are you? So those are a few. But Legos, losing Legos. When me and Zach are trying to build a Lego set or something, and then like you're missing. So what do I do? Well, part of it's selfishly motivated because, as you know, as parents, right, you've bought your kids Legos. You have to take out a small loan to purchase a Lego set for your child. So part of me, it's selfish. I'm like, we paid my hard-earned money for this Lego set. We're finding the piece. But one of the things I do, and I was actually relieved. I had several dads come up to me after first service and go, "Me too." Ted and Terry Sturman, and God bless them. So we have one of those vacuums that has the canister on it. It doesn't bag canister. So I take, does anyone else do that? I take that, and I see Rebecca down here hiding her face. Do you do this, Rebecca? She does. All right. I'm not alone. So I take it, and I empty it into a plastic bag. I put my wilderness headlight on that you can see. It's one of the big ones that you can see a mile away so we can find kids when they get lost in the woods. They say that out loud. That doesn't happen on wilderness. Sorry. I put the headlamp on, and I so poof, I'm illuminating. I have it in the bathtub, in this Meyer bag, and I start going through it, and I'm like, hey, Lego. Lego, you know, and I find the lost Legos. It's gross. It's dusty, and it's like, oh, Cheerios, and here's Chris's hair, and here, you know, and it's like you're sneezing because you're sucking in the dust. But I do. I get this little pile of Legos, and I bring it upstairs, and I sell them back to them. No, I should. Actually, I just thought about that this morning. I'm like, I should sell their Legos back. Zach, right? You'd pay them. Yes, you would. Right, but that's right. That intense. I'm looking, and I'm willing to get down and get dirty to find these lost Legos, and that's what's being communicated here. These people are valuable. Some commentators too speculate that, you know, the difference between the first parable and this one is, you know, in the first parable too, the sheep is lost in the wilderness, and it's wide open. There's a lot of places this sheep could be. Most commentators are reading this, going, you know, that woman seemed pretty confident. She knew that Lego or the Lego. That's in the NIV. That coin was in the house. And all it was going to take was a little bit of effort. And some are speculating, too, that what's being communicated there is this, that it is possible to find lost things. It just sometimes requires some effort and some work. But finding lost things is possible, which would have been another message the Pharisees would have needed to hear, right? Because they had written all these people off. Now, it's possible to find lost things. So again, like the first one, she finds what is lost. She calls her friends, and they rejoice and celebrate together. So in these first two parables, right, we see something of the heart of God. God looks for lost things. They matter. They're valuable. The third parable, or the third movement in the parable, however you want to view it, it continues these themes, but then it expands them a little bit. And the biggest thing it expands is actually this understanding of lostness. Because up to this point, it's been very easy to see the lost as the tax collectors and the prostitutes and the sinners, right? Yes, that's what's lost. But this third parable, it actually expands our understanding of lost a little bit. So Jesus says, there's this son. There's this son. Comes and asks his dad for his part of the inheritance. There's a guy, I can't remember his first name now, Bailey is his last name. He's written extensively on the cultural aspects of Luke's gospel, and then specifically he has a whole book just on Luke 15, and it's so good. He spent a lot of time in the Middle East and just studying the culture and how these different things would look in that culture and the implications, the cultural implications, so on and so forth. He said, when he was doing this research, he said over a 15-year time period, he asked the question hundreds of times, what would a father do in the Middle Eastern culture to a son who came and asked for what this son asked for? And he said, without hesitation, the answer consistently is always this. He would beat him. He would beat him. Why would he beat him? Because in essence, what the son has just said is, I wish you were dead. The money matters more to me than you. And it's just pretty matter of fact. And they said, on top of all that, it would break the father's heart. It would break the father's heart to hear this. So it's a shocking request. But the story gets more shocking because what you see next is the father doesn't beat the son. What is shocking is that the father gives the son what he asks for. It says he takes it and he divided his inheritance and gave it to his son. It's really interesting. That's that word inheritance there. He divided his inheritance. The actual word there is bios. He divided his bios and gave it to his son. Bios, life. He divided his life and gave it to his son. Part of what we have to understand there is the implications of the land and the inheritance. And it was also tied together with identity in the family, that it wasn't just like, here's the credit card or here's the stack of money, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and here it goes. No, the father was giving him part of his life, giving up part of what was the family's, giving up part of their identity. He divided. Shocking that the father doesn't beat the son, but he gives it to him. And in verse 13, we see that the son callously sells off the property, whatever piece of property he was given in other property. He callously sells it off, and it says, in just in a few days, he's gone. He converts it to cash, and he leaves home and journeys to a far country. So not only is the son being painted as wicked and evil because of what he asked the father for, but now he's being painted wicked and evil because he goes to a far country. They would have understood that as like, yeah, he probably drifted into Gentile territory, which is a bad place to go. And I think that's confirmed here in just a little bit when we see that he ends up on a pig farm because Jews didn't do pigs, okay? He's not in Israel, okay? So he goes, journeys into a far country. It gets worse. It's almost like Jesus is trying to paint this kid as disgusting as possible because now he goes and he blows all of the inheritance. He blows his father's bios in wild living. And there's a famine. He has nothing. No one will give him anything. He's hungry. He's starving. And Jesus says, let's do one more thing to make this boy look as bad and as disgusting as possible. This Jewish boy now goes and he's feeding pigs, declared unclean by the Jewish law, feeding pigs. And it's so bad for him, this Jewish boy, that not only is he there contacting pigs and feeding them, but he's looking at what the pigs are eating and going, I want to eat what they're eating. Starving. This kid truly fits in every way everything that disgusted the religious leaders. Everything that disgusted the religious leaders. When he comes to his senses, sorry, Keo, I wasn't keeping up there. He comes to this point where he comes to his senses. He came to himself, the text says. And he starts talking to himself. He says, this is crazy. The lowest servant in my father's household has more than I have here. And he concocts this plan. And I'm going to go home. And I'm going to admit to my father that what I did was wrong. And I'm going to tell him I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. That ship has sailed. What I did was heinous, and I don't deserve to be called your son. Make me as one of your hired servants. Most commentators agree, too, what he is, part of what is going on in his mind there is this, the level of servitude he was asking for wasn't even one of the servants that would live on the property, but he would be a servant who lived off property, who would be contracted in every once in a while. And most likely his plan was that he would make money back to pay back his father for the inheritance. Was again, it's speculative to an extent, but pretty good reasoning to think that that's probably what was in his plan, trying to restore some honor even a little bit, okay? His loss, I'm going to go back, I'm going to earn my way back. So he starts walking home. And the text is so specific in its language. When he was a long way off, the father sees him. The text doesn't say, I can't help but wonder. If late in the day, every single day, that father went out and looked down the road, I would have. Is he going to come home today? And one day he's there and he's looking. The father has already completely blown off cultural expectations and everything he's done to this point, giving the inheritance and letting the son go. He takes it to another level now, though. Because wealthy landowners in Middle Eastern cultures, they don't do what the father does next. He lifts his robes. He exposes his legs. And he runs. And he runs to a disgusting son who insulted him in the greatest way possible and in every way shatters cultural protocol as what this father, what this wealthy landowner should have done. Because they don't do that. They don't lift their robes. They don't expose their legs. And they certainly don't run to that type of person. And I think part of the reason why this happens is this. A long way off. That son walks into the village. What do you think's waiting for him as he walks into that village?
He had dishonored everybody. He had dishonored his family. He had dishonored his city, his village. He looked horrible. We gather that from the description. He had no shoes on. He's walking back into the city. He's going to be made fun of. He's going to be sneered at. He's going to be degraded. He's going to be called the foulest of names. You know why the father runs to the son? Yes, to see him and to love on him. But you know what? The father is protecting the son. He is not going to allow his son to walk back into that village and be subject to all of that. Though he deserves it. Not only, though, is he going to accompany his son back, but he starts demanding things happen, right? Bring to him the best robe. Who had the best robe, by the way, in that family? His dad's. Bring him the best robe. Go get my robe. Put it on him. I don't care. He doesn't need a shower first. Put the robe on him. Go get the ring. What did the ring signify? Probably had a family seal on it. Put the ring on and put shoes on his feet, because barefoot, it was a sign of poverty. And my son is not going to be viewed that way. Confers on him all the marks of sonship, reinstatement into the family. Now let's walk back into the village together. Under my protection, under my name. Wow. Note that the son never finishes the speech that he had planned to give. He got through the part of, I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. He didn't get to the part, make me one of your hired servants. You know why? He couldn't. In the face of such an outpouring of love and grace, number one, to do so would have been highly insulting. But number two, I just don't think he could do it. I think he realized it's pointless. It doesn't need to be asked for. And he's shattered by the outpouring of a reckless grace. A grace without bounds. Takes him back in. And once again, there's a celebration. Go get steak. Go kill the fatty calf. We're having steak tonight. Right? It's my way of celebrating, by the way. All right, let's do this. And by the way, you're killing a fatted calf. That means the whole village is invited. This wasn't a party just for the family. You're feeding everybody. So the celebration starts probably mid-afternoon or something. They start cooking this thing, and they start doing all of this. The men start coming home from the fields. The older brother re-enters the picture here. Celebration would have already started way before the meal began. It would have continued late into the night. Children generally weren't invited into the meal, so the children would have been out front, these younger, and they would have been out there partying and having fun, kind of enjoying it from a distance, and the son encounters these little servants, possibly a young boy, as he walks back into town. He said, "What is going on at my house? Your brother came home." Should be happy about this, right? He's not. He's angry. He refuses to go in. And here's why this is the story of the prodigal sons, plural, and not the prodigal son, singular. Because he refuses to go in. Here's an amazing thing, right? Once again, the father comes out to seek what is lost. And this time it's the older son. And it comes out and it says he begs him, he entreats him to come in. But then the older brother shows us his heart. This shows us that all along he too had been a prodigal. It just looked different. See, he's the Pharisee. Outward obedience, but a heart far away. And his answer to the father reveals what's in his heart. He addresses his father with no title. Up to this point in the story, any time that there had been an address to the father, even by the younger son, the title father had been used. The older son doesn't use the title here. It's shameful the way he's talking to his dad. All these years I slaved for you, but you never did this for me. A couple things are revealed there. One, he finds it would have been a better reason to celebrate to have been given a goat so he could have fun with his friends. That was more of a reason to celebrate for him than the fact that his brother has come back safe and sound. Very pharisaical. Also seems to reveal this, that all along he never really cared about the father. Doesn't seem like he ever really served the Father out of love for the Father. He's serving the Father out of what does it mean for me? What could I get out of it, right? Here's the thing about Pharisees. Their righteousness is almost always self-serving. It's always about their standing, their recognition, and even earning their favor with God. He distances himself from the Father. He distances himself from his brother. This son of yours, he's not even willing to call him his brother. Squandered his lifestyle with prostitutes. How did he know? He didn't know what the brother did. It wasn't Facebook. He's painting his brother out in the worst possible way. He's using terminology from Deuteronomy that shows the most rebellious and wicked of children. Right? He demonstrates self-righteous assumptions and characteristics. And the other thing is the whole thing plays out publicly, by the way. So the older son now humiliates his father in front of the guests. And now we see why both sons at some point were both considered lost. Both of them at some point have demonstrated a disregard for the father. They just demonstrate it in different ways. The prodigal's demonstration was outward and brash. The older son's was inward and selfish. He never really cared about the father. He served only for what he could get out of it. But once again, we see the love of God in a beautiful way. My son, Technon, my little child. He should have beat the older son here. Culture, he should have beat him publicly. My son, my little child. See, for the second time, the father is shamed by a son and treated foully and rudely by a son. But he doesn't berate him. He said, listen, you've always been with me. I've seen it, I know. And all I have is yours. The inheritance is yours. But it's fitting to celebrate because your brother was lost. We thought he was dead. And he's found. Come into the feast. And the story doesn't end. Well, it does. But there's no resolution. Does he come into the feast? We don't know. The invitation is left hanging out there for all who are lost. Prodigal sons and Pharisees alike. And I would ask you today, regardless of where you find yourself, have you come in to the feast? Because the Father's there saying, come on. I love this. Sometimes we get the impression that Jesus hated the Pharisees. He didn't. He's inviting them in right here. And if you have come into the feast, then the next question is this, then are you willing to joyfully embrace then the work of the Good Shepherd of reaching out and loving the lost and joyfully doing it so we can see other people restored? That's what we're called to.